that it was from then on that he left behind the shadows of his childhood, because it had all been an illusion, a fake, a forgery, a scrawling across his mind that had falsely made him go in one direction when he had been meant to go in another. "I've had a kind of dream for a while now," he confessed to me the night he told me he had agreed to join the 11th expedition, "a new one, and not really a nightmare this time." In these dreams, he floated over a pristine wilderness as if from the vantage point of a marsh hawk, and the feeling of freedom is indescribable. It's as if you took everything from my nightmares and reversed it. As the dreams progressed and repeated, they varied in their intensity and their viewpoint. Some nights he swam through the marsh canals. Others, he became a tree or a drop of water. Everything he experienced refreshed him. Everything he experienced made him want to go to Area X. Although he couldn't tell me much, he confessed that he already had met several times with people who recruited for the expeditions, that he had talked to them for hours, that he knew this was the right decision. It was an honor. Not everyone was taken. Some were rejected and others lost the thread along the way. Still others, I pointed out to him, must have wondered what they had done after it was too late. All I understood of what he called Area X at the time came from the vague official story of environmental catastrophe, along with rumors and sideways whispers. Danger? I'm not sure this crossed my mind so much as the idea that my husband had just told me he wanted to leave me and had withheld the information for weeks. I was not yet privy to the idea of hypnosis and reconditioning, so it did not occur to me that he might have been made suggestible during his meetings. My response was a profound silence as he searched my face for what he thought he hoped to find there. He turned away, sat on the couch, while I poured myself a very large glass of wine and took the chair opposite him. We remained that way for a long time. A little later, he started to talk again about what he knew of Area X, about how his work right now wasn't fulfilling, how he needed more of a challenge. But I wasn't really listening. I was thinking about my mundane job. I was thinking about the wilderness. I was wondering why I hadn't done something like he was doing now, dreaming of another place and how to get there. In that moment, I couldn't blame him, not really. Didn't I sometimes go off on field trips for my job? I might not be gone for months, but in principle, it was the same thing. The arguing came later, when it became real to me. But never pleading, I never begged him to stay. I couldn't do that. Perhaps he even thought that going away would save our marriage, that somehow it would bring us closer together. I don't know. I have no clue. Some things I will never be good at. But as I stood beside the psychologist's body, looking out to sea, I knew that my husband's journal waited for me, that soon I would know what sort of nightmare he had encountered here. And I knew, too, that I still blamed him fiercely for his decision. And yet, even so, somewhere in the heart of me, I had begun to believe there was no place I would rather be than in Area X. I had lingered too long and would have to travel through the dark to make it back to base camp. If I kept up a steady pace, I might make it back by midnight. There was some advantage in arriving at an unexpected hour, given how I had left things with the surveyor. Something always warned me against staying at the lighthouse overnight. Perhaps it was just the unease of seeing the strangeness of the psychologist's wound, or perhaps I still felt as if a presence inhabited that place. But regardless, I set out soon after gathering up my knapsack full of supplies and my husband's journal. Behind me lay the increasingly solemn silhouette of what was no longer really a lighthouse, but instead a kind of reliquary. As I stared back, I saw a thin green fountain of light gushing up, framed by the curve of the dunes, and felt even more resolved to put miles between us. It was the psychologist's wound, from where she lay on the beach, glowing more brightly than before. The suggestion of some sped-up form of life burning fiercely did not bear close scrutiny. Another phrase I had seen copied in her journal came to mind. There shall be a fire that knows your name, and in the presence of the strangling fruit, its dark flame shall acquire every part of you. Within the hour, the lighthouse had disappeared into the night, and with it the beacon the psychologist had become. The wind picked up, the darkness intensified. The ever more distant sound of waves was like eavesdropping on a sinister whispering conversation. I walked as quietly as possible through the ruined village, under just a sliver of moon, unwilling to risk my flashlight. The shapes in the exposed remains of rooms had gathered a darkness about them that stood out against the night, and in their utter stillness I sensed an unnerving suggestion of movement. I was glad to soon be past them and onto the part of the trail where the reeds choked both the canal on the seaward side and the little lakes to the left. In a while I would encounter the black water and cypress trees, vanguard for the sturdy utility of the pines. A few minutes later, the moaning started. For a moment, I thought it was in my head. Then I stopped abruptly, stood there listening. Whatever we had heard every night at dusk was at it again. And in my eagerness to leave the lighthouse, I had forgotten it lived in the reeds. This close, the sound was more guttural, filled with confused anguish and rage. It seemed so utterly human and inhuman that for the second time since entering Area X, I considered the supernatural. The sound came from ahead of me and from the landward side, through the thick reeds that kept the water from the sides of the trail. It seemed unlikely I could pass by without it hearing me. And what then? Finally, I decided to forge ahead. I took out the smaller of my two flashlights and crouched as I turned it on, so the beam couldn't easily be seen above the reeds. In this awkward way, I walked forward, gun drawn in my other hand, alert to the direction of the sound. Soon I could hear it closer, if still distant, pushing through the reeds as it continued its horrible moaning. A few minutes passed, and I made good progress. Then, abruptly, something nudged against my boot, flopped over. I aimed my flashlight at the ground and leapt back, gasping. Incredibly, a human face seemed to be rising out of the earth. But when, after a moment, nothing further happened, I shone my light on it again and saw it was a kind of tan mask made of skin, half transparent, resembling in its way the discarded shell of a horseshoe crab. A wide face with a hint of pockmarks across the left cheek. The eyes were blank, sightless, staring. I felt as if I should recognize these features, that it was very important, but with them disembodied in this way, I could not. Somehow the sight of this mask restored to me a measure of the calm that I had lost during my conversation with the psychologist. No matter how strange, a discarded exoskeleton, even if part of it resembled a human face, represented a kind of solvable mystery. One that, for the moment at least, pushed back the disturbing image of an expanding border and the countless lies told by the southern reach. When I bent at the knees and shone my flashlight ahead, I saw more detritus from a kind of molting, a long trail of skin-like debris, husks, and sloughings. Clearly, I might soon meet with what had shed this material, and just as clearly, the moaning creature was, or had once been, human. I recalled the deserted village, the staring eyes of the dolphins. A question existed there that I might in time answer in too personal a way. But the most important question in that moment was whether just after molting the thing became sluggish or more active. It depended on the species, and I was not an expert on this one, nor did I have much stamina left for a new encounter, even though it was too late to retreat. Continuing on, I came to a place on the left where the reeds had been flattened, veering off to form a path about 3 feet wide. The moltings, if that's what they were, veered off too. Shining my flashlight down the path, I could see it curved sharply right, after less than 100 feet. This meant that the creature was already ahead of me, out in the reeds, and could possibly circle back and emerge to block my path back to base camp. The dragging sounds had intensified, almost equal to the moaning. A thick musk clung to the air. I still had no desire to return to the lighthouse, so I picked up my pace. Now the darkness was so complete I could only see a few feet ahead of me, the flashlight revealing little or nothing. I felt as if I were moving through an encircling tunnel. The moaning grew still louder, but I could not determine its direction. The smell became a special kind of stench. The ground began to sag a little under my weight, and I knew water must be close. There came the moaning again, as close as I'd ever heard it, but now mixed with a loud, thrashing sound. I stopped and stood on tiptoe to shine my flashlight over the reeds, to my left, in time to see a great disrupting wave of motion ahead at a right angle to the trail and closing fast. A dislocation of the reeds, a fast smashing that made them fall as if machine threshed. The thing was trying to outflank me, and the brightness within me surged to cover my panic. I hesitated for just a moment. Some part of me wanted to see the creature, after having heard it for so many days. Was it the remnants of the scientist in me, trying to regroup, trying to apply logic when all that mattered was survival? If so, it was a very small part. I ran. It surprised me how fast I could run. I'd never had to run that fast before. Down the tunnel of blackness lined with reeds, raked by them and not caring, willing the brightness to propel me forward, to get past the beast before it cut me off. I could feel the thudding vibration of its passage, the rasping clack of the reeds beneath its tread, and there was a kind of expectant tone to its moaning now that sickened me with the urgency of its seeking. From out of the darkness there came an impression of a great weight aimed at me from my left, a suggestion of the side of a tortured, pale visage and a great ponderous bulk behind it. Barreling toward a point ahead of me, and me with no choice but to let it keep coming, lunging forward like a sprinter at the finish line, so I could be past it and free. It was coming so fast, too fast. I could tell I wasn't going to make it, couldn't possibly make it, not at that angle, but I was committed now. The crucial moment came. I thought I felt its hot breath on my side, flinched and cried out even as I ran. But then the way was clear, and from almost right behind me I heard a high keening and the feeling of the space. The air suddenly filled, and the sound of something massive trying to break, trying to change direction, and being pulled into the reeds on the opposite side of the trail by its own momentum. An almost plaintive keening, a lonely sound in that place, called out to me, and kept calling, pleading for me to return, to see it entire, to acknowledge its existence. I did not look back. I kept running. Eventually, gasping for air, I stopped. On rubbery legs, I walked until the trail opened up into forest lands, far enough to find a large oak I could climb, and spent the night in an uncomfortable position wedged into a crook of the tree. If the moaning creature had followed me there, I don't know what I would have done. I could still hear it, though far distant again. I did not want to think about it, but I could not stop thinking about it. I drifted in and out of sleep, one watchful eye on the ground. Once something large and snuffling paused at the base of the tree, but then went on its way. Another time, I had the sense of vague shapes moving in the middle distance, but nothing came of it. They seemed to stop for a moment, luminous eyes floating in the dark, but I sensed no threat from them. I held my husband's journal to my chest like a talisman to ward off the night, still refusing to open it. My fears about what it might contain had only grown.